regions of Iraq and Syria, and in the Druze regions of Syria to Israel. The Druze-majority areas of southern Syria, in particular in Reef Damascus and Soweto province, are considered by the Israeli regime to be the closest areas to the interior of Syria in terms of security, with the potential for long-term investment in the implementation of these plans and programs.
There have been moves recently when there were clashes between the Druze factions in Jarumana, which is to the southeast of Damascus, that Israel would intervene to protect the Druze, and the Druze have become sort of a protected minority in Syria by Israel. You will notice that HTS are not going near the Druze. They are protecting them. Of course, they don't really care about the Druze. They just see the Druze as a means to actually advance closer to Damascus.
The Druze, a religious minority that separated from the Ismailis in the 5th century, have a rich history of presence in the Levant, especially in the southern regions of present-day Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, spanning over 1,000 years.
I mean, you have the leadership being managed by NATO and the United States doing all they can to try to tamp down on these sectarian tensions. But then you have their followers, their goon squads, literal death squads that ravaged Syria for years, rampaged into religious minority communities, slaughtering people, forcing them to start their own militias. And they're on the loose now.
Their significant role in the emergence of modern Syria, conflicts with the French government for Syrian independence, and contributions to Arab nationalism in the early 20th century have cemented the Druze's position on the Syrian political scene, with figures like Sultan Pasha al-Atrash holding strong historical significance in Syrian nationalism. But why are the Zionists currently in a hurry to establish such a corridor and in this process have initiated a new occupation, massacred the people of southern Syria, suppressed their protests, and attempted to fuel ethnic tensions?
Which is basically a channel up the eastern border of Syria, linking with the Kurdish separatists in the northeast under the control of the US, but also acting as a settler proxy for Israel in that area, close to the east of the Euphrates, and eventually to link up with the Euphrates in Iraq. This is the Greater Israel plan, and this is what Israel is basically working towards right now.
In the coming years, the world will witness significant changes in the trade routes connecting the East and the West. There's fierce competition among various well-known corridor plans that have been mentioned many times in the media. The most famous of them is the One Belt, One Road initiative, often referred to as the Silk Road of the New Era, proposed by China, which aims to connect Chinese soil with Iran, the Middle East, and ultimately the European market. But which countries will be involved in this connection? Could Syria, with its extensive history, once again serve as a transit highway and a passage corridor between the East and the West? Ever since Benjamin Netanyahu proposed the India-Israel Corridor Plan at the United Nations, which aims to pass through the Persian Gulf Arab states and eventually connect to European territory through the occupied territories, experts have considered it as the main competitor to China's New Silk Road, which follows a similar corridor through China, Iran, Turkey, and Europe. Given there's greater likelihood of China's New Silk Road plan being implemented compared to the New Delhi-Tel Aviv corridor plan, the Zionists consider David's corridor as a suitable disruptor against the China-Europe corridor, a plan aiming to directly challenge the interests, integrity, and stability of Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Despite their apparent support for the new Syrian government and their recognition of it as an important member of the Arab League, most of the Persian Gulf countries are not likely to be upset about the weakening of Syria through the implementation of David's Corridor and the decline in the importance of the Silk Road route in favor of the India-Israel Corridor. The development and progress of the southern Persian Gulf countries have historically been impacted by the instability, war, and insecurity in the northern Persian Gulf countries over the past century, and as a result, they will strive to prevent countries like Iraq and Syria from becoming a hub for connecting major trade routes between China and Europe. If Syria achieves complete political stability and preserves its territorial integrity, it has the potential to once again become an important transit route in the China-Europe corridor, just as it did in ancient times. A road and rail route passing through Iran and Iraq that is connected to several highways and railways in Syria and has the potential to connect to European soil through two possible routes. The first route involves passing from east to west Syria, reaching the ports of Latakia, Tartus, and Banias, and then using the sea trade route to southern Europe. The second involves reviving the railway line from south to north Syria, similar to the famous Hejaz Railway during the Ottoman Empire, which would connect the trade route to Turkey and then eastern Europe. Implementing such a plan could bring significant economic benefits to the Syrian people, help maintain the country's integrity, and enable Syria to rejoin the international community as a stable country, free from insecurity and chaos. However, the Zionist regime is actively working against Syria's interests and the transformation of the country into a transit highway on the east-west trade route of the world by planning to create a separatist corridor. Although the heroic people of Syria, after enduring 14 years of civil war, are still expressing dissatisfaction with the new government in Damascus and have refrained from openly opposing the new Jolani government in order to maintain relative peace and prevent further conflict, they have courageously confronted the new Zionist invasion and occupation in Kenitra, Dara, and Rif Dimashq from the outset, and despite the silence and inaction of the current Syrian government, the people have actively resisted the Zionist enemy, thwarting their dangerous attempts to divide Syria and establish the David's Corridor. Numerous Syrian youth have tragically lost their lives or sustained injuries in protests against the establishment of Israeli military bases in southern Syria. Given that the fall of Bashar al-Assad and the rise of the coalition led by Tahrir al-Sham are viewed by many as a resurgence of Sunnis in power in Syria, the Israeli regime has sought to exploit identity divisions within the country, particularly among the Druze, Christian, and Alawite religious minorities, in its endeavors to further its interests. In the midst of these conflicts, Israel not only announced its support for the Druze forces fighting the new government in Damascus, but also carried out significant bombardments of military positions in Syria, highlighting its intention to exploit the socio-political divide in the country. Currently, despite the presence of the Jolani security forces in the Druze areas south of Damascus, in agreement with the Sueda Druze, which includes a selection of the province's security forces from local residents, and the retention of weapons by the Druze armed groups, has resulted in the acknowledgement of Sueda province's relative autonomy in future political landscape of post-Assad Syria. A situation that also provides Israel with the potential to utilize it for future destabilization of Syria.
Attacks on the Kurds as we saw yesterday in Manbij, must be stopped. It's a commitment of the international community towards those who fought bravely against ISIS. It's also a commitment for the future of Syria.
Taking a geopolitical perspective on Syria's eastern neighbors brings to light the significant economic and energy aspects of the David's Corridor project. Israel is seeking to exploit the differences between the Kurdish and Druze minorities and the Arab, Turkish, and Persian majorities in Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran to incite confrontations between the minorities and the surrounding majorities. The Kurds and Druze hold deep historical roots in the region, while Israel is perceived as an externally introduced entity that does not align with the ethnic and geographical makeup of the area. Should the Kurdish and Druze minorities align with Israel and synchronize their interests, they'll likely be drawn into conflicts with regional governments and ethnic majorities, resulting in detrimental long-term consequences and bloodshed that would not serve the best interests of the Kurdish or Druze communities. The Kurdistan region of Iraq, an autonomous region, possesses significant oil and gas reserves as well as ample water resources, providing potential leverage over the central government of Iraq and neighboring countries like Iran and Turkey. This strategic location has long been viewed as a potential tool for political maneuvering by Israel to exert influence and pressure on major Middle Eastern states. The lack of national unity and cohesive ties within Iraqi society, combined with the central government, has historically created opportunities for external influence, in particular from Israel, and the prospect of Kurdish autonomy or independence has been perceived as a threat to Iraq's territorial integrity and a potential security risk extending even to the western borders of Iran. Despite some analysts expressing optimism about the future of Syria and its unity, the current tense situation and the potential future events raise serious doubts about the country's prospects. The tragic incident of March 2025 in the western coastal region of Syria, predominantly inhabited by the Alawites, which resulted in loss of hundreds of Syrian lives, highlighted the ongoing instability that still persists in the country. The violence was sparked by alleged attacks from armed groups loyal to the former Syrian government on security forces associated with Jolani, leading to a devastating loss of life among civilians, and if this trend persists, it could potentially be exploited by foreign actors, in particular Israel, for their own strategic interests.
So they funded the jihadists everywhere. Exactly. And by the way, it's not even, we made Al-Qaeda, I think everyone understands this. We made Osama bin Laden. We made this, the overthrow in Syria where they're saying, oh my God, it's HTS. What do you think? This was what Obama tasked in 2011-12, jihadists.
This situation and the concerning prospect of Syria's imminent collapse is a direct consequence of the absence of a strong and stable government in the capital and the deep-seated cultural and social disintegration within the nation.
That's the sphere that we would call a security zone for Israel. Now, cannot that all be accomplished? Not immediately, but from the Israeli standpoint, the key to success is the destruction of Iran, which in their minds is the single opponent left in the region that can put up resistance, because they think they can bully Saudi Arabia and the Emirates into doing whatever they want.
Syria has now become a country that has lost a large part of its conventional armed forces, following Israeli assaults shortly after the fall of the previous government. Furthermore, country's vital port and shipping infrastructure has been extensively damaged, exacerbating the already dire situation for the populace in areas beyond the control of the Jolani administration, leading to widespread livelihood issues and severe lack of essential infrastructure. In other words, the Zionist regime's stated goals may not simply be the occupation of this vast land, but rather the domination and expansion of influence within this vast region. The combination of these issues and challenges is leading to Israel, perceived as a common enemy by the Syrian people and other Muslim nations in the region, embarking on a highly concerning occupation plan and laying the groundwork for its implementation.
They had their patches, ISIS and Al-Qaeda patches, on their arms. They were chanting obscenely the name of God whilst they murdered people in cold blood, many hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them. And yet, this massacre of the minorities in Syria over the last few days is virtually unreported on Western media, particularly in those countries that did the most to put these maniacs into power, to usher the black flags of ISIS and Al-Qaeda into Damascus. Their media, so tightly controlled, they're not even reporting a massacre of Christian people, of Alawi people, of Shia and Druze people, by their clients, by their agents, by the people they armed and funded.
The Davis Corridor stands out as one of Israel's significant tools and plans aimed at exerting a substantial influence on the geopolitical and political dynamics in the region, particularly within Syria. This plan, considering the unique identities and historical gaps of the countries in the region, with a particular focus on Syria, which is located on the borders of occupied Palestine, is expected to greatly influence Israel's geopolitical future and aims to capitalize on the opportunities arising from the Syrian crisis over the past 15 years.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today in The Key, we're going to be examining a very important topic and issue. That issue is related to one of the good moral characteristics, which is a virtue that we have been encouraged to adopt in Islam. I am speaking, of course, of the virtue of clemency. Clemency, which in Arabic we call hilm, is very close to patience and forbearance. In some of our previous sessions, we talked about why it's so virtuous and what are the things that bring it about or what are its causes. In this beautiful and very significant topic that we want to talk about today is what are the fruits of clemency, meaning what are its effects or what does it lead to? In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from some of the hadiths which have been narrated regarding this very significant topic. In one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, One who is clement has the upper hand. Man haluma sada. It's possible to also translate this hadith as follows. One who is clement achieves success or becomes successful. Not necessarily has the upper hand over, you know, his opponents or, you know, his enemies. But in any case, if we translate the hadith in the first way, the meaning of the hadith, the intent of the hadith is very clear, that if we want to, you know, be victorious or successful and overcome, you know, our, you know, things that are opposing us, we need to be patient, and with patience and clemency we can resolve that conflict and, you know, become successful and achieve victory. In another beautiful hadith, kind of echoing the same theme, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, one who is clement with his enemy is victorious. This doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, one who waits to attack his enemy or who waits for the opportune time to vanquish him will be victorious. It could also mean one who is clement with his enemy and in forgiving the enemy and, you know, not unnecessarily harming his enemy. You know, such a person will ultimately be victorious, you know, and successful in this conflict that he has with this external force which opposes him. Again, in another beautiful hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, the very first recompense for the qualities of the clement person is that the people will assist him against the ignorant one. So this is one of the social effects of clemency, is that people will come to the aid of the person who is clement and forbearing with them. You know, people like such a person. They rally around him and they assist him in his objectives. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he also said, clemency in the midst of severe anger will protect one from the anger of the Almighty. This is a otherworldly effect of clemency, in that if a person is angry, he should be clement, and Allah will be clement with him in the akhirat and in the hereafter. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the fruits of clemency in the light of the hadith of the infallible Imams, alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
to be as true as I can to you. Cause loving you the best I can will always be my number one and only plan. Yes, every day I'll try to be as true as I can to you.
Thinkers who refuse to follow the script, who question the machinery of global power and offer alternative visions rooted in lived experience and historical depth. My guest today is one such figure, a scholar activist whose journey has taken him from the lecture halls of Sydney to the front lines of international resistance. His work invites us to reconsider what we think we know about sovereignty, development, and the forces that shape our world. Welcome to SOAP. I am Bahman Ray.
Tim Anderson is an Australian political economist, writer and activist known for his critiques of Western imperialism and advocacy for independent development. Formerly a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney, his academic work spans decades and includes books on Latin America, Syria and global resistance movements. His career has been marked by both scholarly contributions and public controversy, including legal battles over academic freedom.
Mr. Tim Anderson, very good to finally see you in person.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming to the show.
Very welcome.
Tim, is it all right for me to call you Tim for the sake of the interview? What first sparked your interest in political economy and global justice?
I think I was growing up during one of the post-World War II wars. And of course, the involvement of my own country in Vietnam had a very deep impact on me when I was at school and when I was at university. And then there was also the civil rights movement in the US, and that flowed on to the indigenous rights movement in Australia. So those things together had a very big influence on me on the way that I saw the world, I think.
And what did you decide to do about it in order to kind of gain some knowledge regarding what you were feeling at the time?
Well, there was something very wrong, even when I was very young, to me about the idea of going to Vietnam, sending young men to Vietnam to kill people there in their country. What was the point of that? And then when it came to the indigenous rights movement, this idea of the self-determination of a people became very important to me and still very important today. It's very formative in terms of the way I look at international relations and struggles around the world. Resistance, in a way, is the flip side of self-determination. So it led me a long way, but really I was thinking about that at the time. And of course I was inspired by the independence movements in the 70s in particular, you know, and that's why I was interested in Latin America, and I went to Latin America later on.
Right, and these could be like formative experiences that kind of shaped your worldview. And then in terms of studies, how did you decide to proceed?
The same thing, really. I went to university to study science because I liked nature, and I thought I'd be interested in scientific studies. But eventually, I moved back into the humanities and into social sciences and into political economy eventually, because I think I realized that economics was important and I shouldn't be ignorant about it. But then I came back to this idea of self-determination and resistance, and those themes that have run through what I've been writing for a very long time, particularly in recent years.
Right, and what school of political economy are you a fan of?
Well, we had a pluralist approach in the department I was in for about 20 years, so we had to teach, in a sense, political economic literacy to students. So they had to understand liberalism, Marxism, institutionalism, other type feminism, other types of ideologies, different ways of looking at the same issues, which I think was useful pedagogically, you know. But then in terms of analysis, of course, for me it was always horses for courses. There were particular types of methods you would apply to particular types of problems. So I didn't really dedicate myself or commit myself to one particular line of ideology, for example.
So do you think that each of the models would be suitable depending on the region where they are applied, or do you think there could be one formula for the entire world?
Look, there are human values behind all of them, basically, and I think that's important. I was influenced by a few different schools, the Indian esotericism, Latin American humanism. Now, the humanism in Latin America applied to other cultures and across different religions became very important to me. And I've had the privilege in my life to visit many, many cultures. I've been in dozens of different cultures and tried to be someone who could read and listen to people. And it occurred to me, traveling from, you know, Pacific Islands to the Arab world and Latin America, that there were some common values that cross cultures. People really understood those things, and they were values formed in older traditional cultures, although modernist thought makes us think of tradition as something that weighs people down. But I came to accept that tradition had a lot of very valuable human values, and they did cross cultures, and so therefore other cultures could understand each other. There was a type of a common language, a human type of language that crossed those sorts of cultures. And there was very good values in all cultures in some way. Of course, there were bad things in all cultures too. But nevertheless, I saw that link between different cultures. That was one of the things I learned from visiting many different cultures, and including indigenous cultures. You know, when you see the type of hospitality and reciprocity and types of human connections in the Arab world, in the indigenous world, in the Pacific, then you think there's something here that actually is not really to do with their specific histories. Specific histories are important, but I think the things that connect us as human beings are very important too.
Well, focusing on indigenous people and the justice system that they had, the judicial system that they had, do you believe that, with the kind of knowledge that you have regarding them, do you believe that the modern world has been able to create a system that is as valuable as those old traditional systems?
No, I don't think so. I think there are some benefits of modernism, but there's also imperial modernism, you know, so there are modernism as a construct completely is not an answer to anything really, and the problem is the fact that it can destroy some very valuable traditional values and cultures and ways of managing the earth, for example, is extremely important. One of the things I was talking about with some friends here in Tehran this week is the link between the environmental movement and the genocide in Gaza. You know, really, that there's something very important that's missing in the environmental movement if it doesn't include the sustainable reproduction of human life and human values. And that's perhaps what's missing in the environmental movement now. So I think there are lessons from all sides here. And in the formation of some human ideologies, we have to take account of many, many aspects, whether they're traditional or modern.
Right, that was a very beautiful way of putting this. But you mentioned the genocide in Gaza, and looking at it from an environmental point of view, that was, for me, it was a first, and it was very interesting and really touched a certain spot in me. How do you think we can bring this sort of talk to the mainstream media?
Look, it's a battle of ideas. As the late Fidel Castro said, we are engaged in a battle of ideas and trying to promote human values. And the problem is that we have some very institutionalized, hegemonic, domineering ideas. And when you talk about the mass media, really you're talking about a media which, in a sense, is a key forward part of that hegemonic project. You know, it's really the enemy in many respects of human values. So therefore, independent media and alternative media and the media from voices that aren't, or subaltern voices, as they sometimes say, become more and important. We have some opportunities now, but in many respects, I don't think it's important to focus on changing those ossified institutions that represent hegemonic values. I really think we have to bypass them and create some new institutions, some new cultures in the world.
Like, so you mentioned the role of alternative media, for example. How do you think they can kind of fill in the gap which is left intentionally, if you say so, by the mainstream media in the world?
Look, there are some spaces in what you call the mainstream media, what I typically call the colonial media or the corporate media. There are spaces there, it's true. There are spaces in which we can use our voices, our genuine voices. Sometimes there are limits placed on that. But then we also have to construct some realities where we can talk about actual realities. This was the basis of the Latin Americans, for example, creating Telesur 20 years ago, where they were dominated by a North American Spanish-speaking television system like CNN, for example. And in creating Telesur, the late Hugo Chavez of Venezuela said, this is where our voices come out. And it's a very successful experiment, and it still lasts, and it's got shareholdings and voices from the whole continent of Latin America. So it's an example of what can be done with, for example, television. But I think it's really the political relationship is to try to displace the reliance on or the monopoly of those hegemonic outlets.
Right. I want to know, what drew you to focus on Latin America and the global south in your research?
I think because there were such outstanding examples of struggles for self-determination and creating different societies. We could say experiments in a way, because many of them failed. But nevertheless, the attempts were very important. And in the global south, you will see people have a much more faith in being able to try and construct a new society than in the Western countries, where there's a great deal of cynicism, where it's seen that the state is embedded with autocratic elites and there is no chance to change them at all. Whereas in Latin America, for example, you had the election of a democratic left president, Salvador Allende. We heard that you had this Cuban Revolution. You've had a lot of initiatives. We had the revolution in China, in Vietnam, the struggle for independence in Vietnam. So there are many more inspiring stories from the global south than in the West, where really there's been very little rejection of oligarchic or autocratic rule in the European societies, for example. So there's much more to be learned, I believe, from society and the state in the global south.
Right. So indeed, the talk, the argument of the global south and the Latin American experience that you've had, how close do you find it with the discourse that you hear here in Tehran?
There are very strong links, and I now that you mention that link, I have to point out that the most popular of my tweets on what used to be called Twitter in the recent days has precisely been the relationship between Iran and Venezuela. Now that both countries are under threat and both countries are collaborating in a very material sense in their defense industries, for example. So I know that collaboration has been going on for quite some time, but nevertheless, people in the world, and most of the audience of my social media is English speaking, and probably most of that in North America, but they're very interested in new collaborations, new networks. You know, networks has become increasingly important to me in my life, and when they see real collaborations that breaks the cycle of cynicism and the idea that nothing really changes and, you know, money rules and so on, that enormous amount of cynicism really dominates a lot of thinking in the West. So people wake up a little bit when they see something going on. Oh, there could be something here, you know, could be something different here.
Right, and Ben, I want to talk about the reactions that you get on your X account today. You know, when you talk about these links between Iran and Venezuela in particular, what kind of reactions do you see?
Well, people I'm talking about mainly English-speaking people, I suppose, also right. Latin American-speaking people, because my second language is Spanish, so I also write some things in Spanish, but it's mainly English-speaking. There can be new relations. There can be some break in the monolithic power structures that they've grown up under, and they don't see any hope. They feel like they are a great weight is placed on their shoulders, and where is the possibility of liberation in this monolithic world, basically? And so that's why the talk, which I believe began in Russia, but it was popularized in Latin America, the idea of a multipolar world has really become an inspiring idea. But when people see practicality of it, they're inspired. I myself am inspired by the fact, for example, that Cuban medicines are manufactured in Iran and then exported back to Latin America, for example, because Cuba has great innovations in pharmaceutical industries, for example. But to see that sort of cooperation working in a practical sense. Or to put it another way, I've spent a lot of time on this, the Cuban training of doctors, many, many doctors in my part of the world in developing countries, has been an extraordinary program, and it's something the wealthy countries haven't been able to do at all. But then you see real results, like the training of 1,000 doctors in East Timor, for example, by the Cubans, and they are working there, and they haven't left the country in the brain drain. They've stayed there as salaried public servants working for their communities. It's really an incredibly inspiring story. So those sorts of things really give me some sort of hope, too, about what's possible today.
Right. That's of course, very inspiring to see this sort of collaboration between these countries trying to come up with their own chain of value, but with their own system. But yeah. How far do you think are we from an actual multipolar world?
We are still some way from that, because there's some famous saying by the late Italian communist Antonio Gramsci, but that you know the new order is being born, but the old one hasn't died yet. So that we're in the middle of all these wars, all these hybrid wars now. People talk about World War III, but really what we're faced with these days is a very large number of hybrid wars, which are not global conflagrations, but they're very serious for all the people that involve them, of course. And of course, all of them are rooted back to either the US or the NATO countries, basically. That's where the great threat to humanity is coming from today. I'm quite convinced of it. The US and its NATO allies.
Right. And this world order that you just mentioned, today, especially in the Middle East, of course, we are seeing or the West Asia region, as we call it, we are facing something really new. I think something that has never been experienced before.
Yeah.
Today that we were speaking, yesterday we witnessed an aggression by the Israeli forces in Qatar. Qatar is a friendly country to the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. is so much promoting the idea of Abraham Accords.
Mm-hmm.
But the Israelis seem to go on very roguely, to say the least. And these are new developments that you are witnessing. Do you believe that this is an expansion of the world order that the U.S. still desires? Do you think this is going to be a failed attempt, or do you think they can actually realize that in front of the talk by the likes of Russia and China?
Look, in my latest book, West Asia After Washington, I talk about this as the wars of hegemonic decline, really, that these wars are precisely because there is an old order that's struggling to hang on to its power, and we see this outbreak of the war in Ukraine was really because of the expansion of NATO to try and dominate the whole of Eastern Europe and Russia, and with the Israelis, you know, which is really the flailing out to try and secure the existence of this Anglo-American colony, effectively, in West Asia, in Arab lands, basically. As you said, they attacked Qatar, which is the main U.S. military base in this region, basically, but the day before Syria, and today Yemen. You know, I think six countries this week that they've been bombing. And it's an extraordinary event, and most of the Western regimes are justifying it or trying to cover it up or trying to soften it, massage it in some sort of way. Yet the population of the world, including in the Western countries, is aflame. Really, the Al-Aqsa flood operation, for example, really, and the Israeli reaction to it, really woke up the conscience of the world. I believe that things have changed quite dramatically in the last 2 years. And the fact that there's a violent and vicious outburst by this Israeli colony against the Palestinian people in the first case, but also against all of the other regimes in the region, including ones that actually host the U.S. Military. Well, you know, one thing that's remarkable for me is that, you know, there was a retaliation by Iran against the U.S. military base after they'd bombed Iranian nuclear sites here, but that was in a U.S. base in Qatar. This attack by the Israelis was in the civilian area, residential area of Doha, basically. So there was no limit, apparently, to what the Israelis and the U.S. would do. And, of course, the Israelis had the support of the British and the U.S. We know they're denying it, but we know that's not the case. We know there was logistic support by both the British and the U.S. in this attack. And, of course, they switched off the air defense on their own military base so that the attack could be carried out. So, really, there's no respect for the so-called friends and allies of this Anglo-American project in this part of the world. And it's really part of this, as I said, what I call it is wars of hegemonic decline, trying desperately to hang on to the global domination, the global dictatorship, if you like, of that order when they see things are changing and real substantial powers like Russia and China in coordination with the BRICS and the SCO and with the regional powers like Iran here, are posing a challenge to their dictatorship of the world. They can't tolerate that there are independent states in the world. And even if they're mildly independent, we saw, for example, Saddam Hussein was a collaborator with the US for a very long time. But when he asserted some sort of independence, they crushed that too. And they did it with Noriega in Panama. And of course, there are many, many examples. But this is the changing world we live in, I think.
Right. And of course, this show is going to be at in a few weeks, and there's going to be a lot of developments until then. But the fact that all the news and even the mainstream media were reporting that the Hamas leadership were targeted while in a meeting discussing the US's latest proposal regarding the ceasefire with Israel, the fact that Israel attacks such a meeting, what kind of message does that send across?
Well, I suppose the same message that happened when the Israelis attacked Iran, when there was some sort of delegation in Muscat, in Oman, you know, at the same time.
Before the sixth round, yeah.
Their attempts at diplomacy are entirely cynical. They don't mean anything. They will get what they want by force. They don't believe in reasonable discussion with people. I suppose you could say the same thing about the whole nuclear talks, really, where I've always been surprised as what was there that remains there for Iran. There was only the promise of lifting sanctions, which they never did when they had an agreement, you know. So what's there? There's a great cynicism there. Really, they wanted to disempower Iran as an important player, as an important influence in this region. It had nothing to do with nuclear weapons. It had everything to do with trying to unilaterally disarm an important power in the region, basically, which they simply can't tolerate. They can't tolerate independent powers. They would like to dismantle China. They would like to dismantle Russia. They would like to do all these things. They won't do it, but they simply can't tolerate independent bases of power. And this was spelled out in some of their strategic literature as far back as the 1990s. You know, I think that Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, was important in that respect. In many respects, they're following a formula from Brzezinski's book, you know, to destroy any independent seats of power, to impose this idea of full spectrum dominance, which is a Pentagon theme, and destroying disconnectedness. You know, they've written openly about these sorts of things, and perhaps they've massaged it with more smooth-sounding liberal language in the past. But then when they have cruder leaders like George W. Bush or Donald Trump, the open reality and the brutal reality of this global dictatorship they want to impose is more clear to everyone.
Right, and from the look of things nowadays, wherever Israel goes, America definitely follows. Why the unconditional support for Israel in the US, you think?
Well, I know that there's differences of opinion here, but in my opinion, the Israeli regime is simply an outpost for the Anglo-American empire, basically. Of course, dominated by Washington. So I know some people think that the Israelis are manipulating the US. I think it's the other way around. And in any case, of course, there's a hand-in-glove symbiosis going on there, really, that it's part of, it's their child or their outreach or whatever. Nevertheless, there is this. And of course, the other Western countries are really forced to go along with this too, because they don't have substantial independence. The Europeans, the NATO states, my own country, Australia, really, they're in a humiliating way, they're forced to go along with this, even though they may not like it personally. They may not like Washington being the dictator that it is personally, but they are scared. They're afraid of great damage that can be done to them politically and economically if they don't go along with it. You know, so it's an extraordinary time, really, because, as I said, these wars are a result of the fact that there is a regime trying to hang on to global dominance, which he thinks it's entitled to, an extraordinary exceptionalist entitled mentality. And you see a microcosm of that in the Israeli colony. That's my way of looking at it.
Right, that was very interesting viewpoint. Mr. Tim Anderson, it was a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
Thank you.
We've come to the close of one other SOAP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Uray.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. CIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Greetings from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We'll start off this hour's programs with Youth Station, a program all about young people and dealing with topics related to youth. Next is Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about the current events and issues in the West Asia region. That will be followed by Back to Reality. In this roundtable discussion, young Muslims are invited to discuss some pertinent religious and social issues of today's Islamic world. Our varied radio productions feature will be next.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRAB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth
Station.
This is Asma, and I'm so happy to be here.
And this is Masuma.
I hope wherever you are, you're doing well and everything is just fine with you. How about you, Masuma? Are you okay?
Yes, thank God.
Well, now there comes this subject, which is, I guess, very, very interesting, very challenging, sometimes very paradoxical, and sometimes we have got some illusions about it. Sometimes I ask myself, what kind of a picture do you have of a perfect marriage? Because when I come to count the number of perfect marriages around me, I have this difficulty of finding the real perfect marriages.
We don't have perfect marriage, honey.
Yeah, that's
excuse me here.
That's the thing. That's the point I wanted to make at the end of today's episode, but we made it actually. We're starting backwards.
Yeah. Well, that was because that was too much for me to digest.
Yeah, so this was the conclusion of today's episode, but we made it in the very beginning. We're deconstructing the whole process of episodes in Youth Station.
As you said, that you notice around yourself, I have also noticed people around myself. So I have a very nice friend of mine, which I thought her family and her parents had perfect marriage, okay? But now it has been 5 years since I'm her friend. So obviously we've gotten closer, you know, more friend. I see them more often and all. So now I can see their flaws too. Now I know their past too.
So the first misconception.
Yes.
Perfect marriage does not exist.
Yeah, it does not exist. So that was just something delusional that some people
if
think.
If you still are one of those people who believe in such a notion, I am happy to confess that you very quickly are going to face the truth.
So we can choose what kind of marriage we want. We can choose what kind of problems
I can
deal with.
And you can choose what kind of person you wish to end up having all these problems with.
That is a right. Allah has given me people.
Yeah.
Know that.
At least pick the one you wish to have this imperfect stuff with.
Yes. My chosen imperfect man.
Yeah. Putting all these things aside, marriage has got a lot of prerequisites. Like, you have to get into too much of requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And to only have this imaginary, this castle in the air about marriage, like, I'm going to marry someone who's too perfect of a human being, and our life is going to be like these fairy tales that
ultimate dream
ended happily ever after. All these stuffs are just illusions, unfortunately.
Indeed.
And I guess it's better that they are illusions, because we usually think that what's the use of life if it was all about heaven?
We wouldn't, you know, value it.
And we wouldn't grow.
Yes, we wouldn't develop, we wouldn't grow. That is also a thing.
The process of growing happens. I'm not saying that we love misery, we love hardship, and we love all the imperfect beings. Bring an imperfect being for me.
That's
what I'm striving for. No, it's actually the idea that when we say perfect marriage does not exist, that doesn't mean that all the marriages are too bad and they are hell, do not get into it. No.
Mm-hmm. We don't mean that.
We don't mean that. We mean that do not expect something that you are not from other people.
Definitely.
If I sometimes might get into the trap of, for example, misbehaving, then I have to accept that from others.
You know what? We have this concept. It's a new thing, at least for me in social media, that we have red flags and green flags. They say, for example, oh, that person is red flag, that person is green flag. So I used to think that, oh, if a man, you know, would get angry at me, he's a red flag. But then I noticed I myself get angry sometimes as well. So am I a red flag? Then I think that, okay. So at that point, I realized my own flaws. And then I was like, yes, he has to deal with some of my flaws. So obviously I have to, you know, accept some of his flaws.
So it's all about compromise.
Yes, it's all about compromise.
It's all about compromise.
How much you willingly want to compromise.
Exactly.
And you should, you know, enter the marriage awareness that I know this and I want to compromise with this factor.
Let's crack it right here.
Mm-hmm.
What about your friends? You see a lot of objections you might have to your siblings, but still you can die for them.
Yes, true. I can give my heart and kidneys and everything for them.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Like, if they want my eyes, I can offer it to them. But does that mean we are not going to have fights every day?
No, we are going to still fight.
Yeah, we're going to fight and we might get into very bad corners. But then it's love. It's the mutual love that we have for each other. And I don't think it's a matter of blood as much as it is the matter of spending time with each other and remembering the goodness that I have beside all the badnesses that I have as well. Because we're human beings. And if we do not compromise with people that we love, then I guess life is going to be turning into this very sad